from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm John McMinn.
And I'm Sam Hirschman.
This week on War News Radio, Foreign Affairs, we learn about the role of Chinese investment in Afghanistan.
Then, we hear from a freelance journalist about his time in the Middle East.
Finally, we look at the changing status of foreign correspondents.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Top U.S. officials indicated this week that the U.S. is unlikely to arm Libyan rebels. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton expressed reservations about possible plans that would provide weapons to opposition forces. President Obama himself has not ruled out the possibility of direct military assistance to the rebels. In testimony before Congress, Secretary Gates suggested that the U.S. would not oppose other nations that wish to send arms to the Libyan opposition. France is the only country that has announced its intentions to do so.
Secretary Gates' testimony follows revelations that President Obama has authorized an expanded CIA role in the Libyan conflict. CIA agents have been gathering information about Libyan leader Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi's forces and the nature of the country's opposition for several weeks. Obama has also issued a presidential finding authorizing the CIA to provide money and weapons to Libyan rebels. Administration officials deny, however, that the agents are assisting the rebels and argue that no military aid has been sent.
President Obama defended American involvement in Libya, arguing that the U.S. has a moral interest in preventing massacre in the war-torn nation. The president endorsed airstrikes on Gaddafi's forces while promising that ground troops would not be deployed and the U.S. would not forcibly remove Gaddafi from power. Obama cited the war in Iraq as evidence of the complications of employing ground troops to depose a tyrant. Political analysts are calling this kind of American action, low commitment, internationally supported involvement in a foreign nation on moral grounds, the Obama Doctrine.
Libyan Foreign Minister and former intelligence chief Moussa Koussa escaped from Libya on Wednesday and is now residing in London. Throughout the 90s, Koussa had been the West's key link to the regime as tensions with Libya lessened. However, Koussa's record is far from untarnished, as he was allegedly involved in the planning of the Lockerbie bombing 23 years ago. He is also implicated in several other terrorist attacks. Koussa left his family behind in Libya to defect from the government, saying he was committed to bringing Gaddafi down from power. Meanwhile, Mohammed Ismail, a senior aide to Gaddafi's son Saif al-Islam, came to Britain for talks earlier this week. Some experts have speculated that Ismail's visit shows that Gaddafi's sons are looking for a way out of the current crisis.
According to a new study funded by the U.S. Army Research Laboratory, air pollution in Iraq is putting the long-term health of U.S. soldiers fighting in the country at risk. The study found that the air pollution in Iraq contains dust particles small enough to bypass biological defenses and build up in the lungs. Air samples from Iraq contain lead, dust, aluminum, and other metals in levels far exceeding U.S. air quality standards. Health experts point to the large amount of airborne dust in Iraq, as well as the widespread use of leaded gasoline as causes of the pollution.
A group of armed men seized control of an Iraqi government building in Tikrit. The gunmen blasted their way into the building and took around 30 hostages, killing many of them execution style. After a standoff lasting several hours, Iraqi security forces were able to regain control of the building. All of the gunmen and hostages were killed. During the entire assault, at least 56 people were killed and 98 others wounded. Iraqi officials believe Al-Qaeda was behind the attack.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai publicly condemned the trophy killings carried out by 12 members of the 5th Army Striker Brigade on unarmed Afghan civilians during a 5-month period last year. Rolling Stone magazine published some of the over 100 photos of the atrocities, which had previously been suppressed by the army. They depict American soldiers gleefully standing over the corpses of locals from Kandahar province, whom members of the brigade allegedly trapped and killed for sport. Rolling Stone claims that the murders were well planned, and many soldiers other than the 12 charged were aware of the plans. Specialist Jeremy Morlock pleaded guilty to the crimes at a military tribunal last week.
At least 40 people were kidnapped by insurgents this week in the northeastern Afghan province of Kunar. The Taliban took responsibility for the attack and claimed that all of the kidnapped men were Afghan policemen. Afghan police officials disputed that statement, saying that the kidnapped men were only potential police recruits and that the men were unarmed.
The Taliban have seized control of a district of Nuristan province in the strategic Peck Valley of eastern Afghanistan. According to a press release by the Nuristan province police commander, the government and police of Wegal district have been run out of the area. The United States is drawing down troops from the Peck Valley and transitioning power to Afghan forces, though the 50,000-person Wegal district specifically had not been under foreign control for 4 years. However, the area is considered important due to its proximity to insurgent groups in Pakistan. The Afghan National Army is planning a counterattack to retake the area.
This is War News Radio. A 2010 report by the U.S. Geological Survey and the Pentagon reported that Afghanistan may contain nearly $1 trillion worth of untapped mineral deposits. This mineral wealth has the potential to transform the country, and foreign investors are eager to exploit this investment opportunity. Caroline Batten has more on one specific country's involvement, China.
Since Afghanistan's economy opened up to foreign investment in 2008, China invested nearly $3 billion in the Aynak copper mine, described by a British-Afghan geological survey team as the largest undeveloped copper mine in the world. Developing Aynak, along with other Chinese development projects, could lead to a large influx of capital into the country. But what is China's motivation behind investing?
Infrastructure requires copper. If you look at the need it for piping, you need it for electricity, you need it for a light rail system. It's an extremely valuable element in that it conducts electricity very well, and that's what the Chinese need to develop their infrastructure.
That was James R. Yeager, former consultant to the Afghan Ministry of Mines and Industry, speaking about the motivation behind Chinese investment in the Aynak copper field. But Afghanistan is ideal for Chinese investment in many ways beyond its rich mineral resources. Raffaello Pantucci is a journalist, think tank researcher, an associate fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization, and explains Afghanistan's unique position as a local, undeveloped, mineral-rich nation.
A lot of it's sort of untapped potential. I mean, Afghanistan's been unavailable to people to explore for a very long time. So on the one hand, it's a sort of big untapped place, and China needs lots of raw materials at this point. So clearly it looks to countries where it can get these things or where they haven't been exploited yet. This is why we see China in vast swathes of Africa as well. But then, of course, with Afghanistan sits on its border. It's right next door. So it has the added sort of bonus of being convenient for them.
China also has indirect economic benefits from a developed Afghanistan.
China has out to its west, there's a very big province called Xinjiang, which is one of China's sort of least developed provinces. And so China in part hopes that by developing the sort of immediate periphery, you have the added advantage of having effective developing your own area.
However, the benefits go both ways. Pantucci suggests that development could create real benefits for the Afghan economy.
In many ways, is that a bad thing? I've certainly heard that with the case of Africa, in some of these poor African countries, I know there's a growing consensus amongst sort of the Western diplomatic community and the Western aid community that it may be the case that the Chinese are sort of coming in and doing these deals and bribing people and undercutting Western sort of companies. But you know what? They're getting roads built in countries where there weren't roads before, and that's going to help the sort of general situation. And I would suspect that this is probably quite similar for Afghanistan.
But Yeager explains that not everyone is convinced that Chinese investment is necessarily a good thing for Afghanistan.
For every direct job in mining, 10 indirect jobs are created, and that's suppliers of the indirect job. The problem with the Chinese investment, it's all vertically integrated. Everything will come from China, and you won't have the second tier of the secondary jobs developing in Afghanistan. You know, it's a wait and see. If they really live up to their contract and provide jobs for the people, and the money, in fact, gets back to the people, then it's a good deal. If, in fact, no jobs are created and they bring in their Chinese labor like has happened in the past, then it's just terrible for Afghanistan.
Nevertheless, the underlying political questions regarding foreign investment remain. Pantucci explains the dilemma.
There is the question of the political optics of what it looks like for a Chinese company to sort of sweep in and make money out of a situation where, you know, NATO forces have sort of fought and died. But that's a sort of political thing. I think in the sort of longer run, people would probably look at this picture and say, well, you know, someone's developing somewhere that wasn't developed.
China Metallurgical Group Corporation, or MCC, is the primary investor in the Einak copper mine. Yeager states that Chinese companies like MCC have economic advantages that U.S. or European countries do not.
MCC is 44% owned by the Chinese government. They do not have to be accountable to investors or their boards of directors. If a Western company were to develop Einak, they would have to seek outside investment from finance companies to the tune of $1 billion and would have to be accountable for that money to the investors as well as to their board of directors.
But, as Pantucci tells us, some of these advantages may come from policies that most companies keep under wraps.
Chinese companies may be less hindered by requirements in terms of bribing foreign ministers. I know with previous deals, there was the famous Einak copper mine that the Chinese purchased. There have been all sorts of rumors about the size of the bribe that the Chinese company was able to hand over to the Minister of Mines. And I've heard people say jokingly that other contracts have been held up because they were waiting for the Chinese company to arrive with its bribe. Now, this is all rumor and speculation. But, you know, I know that certainly for Western companies, these things are more difficult than there is maybe.
Ultimately, China's political stances will be guided by its close ally, Pakistan. Pakistan and China are allies due to their mutual rivalry with India, as both have fought separate wars with India.
One has to remember that really China sees this country politically through Pakistan, which is, you know, its greatest and oldest friend. Basically, if you want to look at sort of how the relationship between Iran and Afghanistan will play out in geopolitical terms, you probably need you're better looking at what happens with Pakistan's choosing to do. And at the moment, Pakistan seems to be playing a slightly hedging game in this situation. And so the Chinese are sort of following that lead because one day, and who knows when it'll be, probably quite soon, America will start leaving Afghanistan. And they're uncertain that Afghanistan and the political scene as it is there now is necessarily going to survive. So their concern is the Taliban are someone to come back in power, so they're not going to aggravate the situation. They're not going to get too involved in the internal politics of Afghanistan unless their Pakistani friends call them to do it or ask them to do it.
China continues to aggressively pursue investment opportunities in Afghanistan, most notably the Hajigak iron field, billed by the Afghan Ministry of Mines as potentially the largest undeveloped iron ore deposit in Asia. A recently WikiLeaked U.S. State Department cable noted that if successful in the Hajigak bid, China will become Afghanistan's largest foreign investor. For War News Radio, with Aaron Moser and Alan Zhao, I'm Caroline Batten.
This is War News Radio. For over 10 years, freelance journalist and photographer Yasin Athanasiadis has reported on most of the Middle East and Central Asia for a litany of news outlets, including the BBC, Al Jazeera, Newsweek, and the Christian Science Monitor. In his latest assignment, he covered the protests in Egypt. Jared Nolan talks with him about his perspective on the recent turmoil and his conversations with Afghans.
Yasin Athanasiadis has been around the block. Back in 2009, while covering the presidential elections in Iran, authorities accused him of being a spy and held him in prison for 3 weeks. Since then, he has reported from Afghanistan, and most recently Egypt, during the overthrow of former President Hosni Mubarak. Athanasiadis first visited that country in 2002, but even then he sensed change was on the way.
It was a very fascinating time to be there, and I hadn't been back to Egypt since I'd left. I finished living there in 2002, so all those in my head, I'd said that, you know, once this revolution happened, and to me it was very clear that it would happen, my friend would say, no, it's impossible. The Egyptian people will never rise up. It's not in their DNA, and so on.
To Athanasiadis, the imminent revolution was clear for a number of reasons.
Well, just how terrible things were on a day-to-day basis. I'd never been in a country where So many people lived in such poor conditions, in such a small, geographically limited amount of space. When you put 85 million people, when you squeeze them into such a narrow space, and add to that unemployment in the high 20s, youth unemployment in the 40s, massive underemployment across society, a calcified regime with socialist roots trying to push through liberalization, capitalist liberalization that's resulting in even more inequality and even more sort of rampant inequality across society, something's got to pop.
These multiple layers of complexity are what motivate Athanasiadis as a journalist. As a Harvard Nieman Fellow in 2007, he wrote that these nearly insurmountable complications cause misunderstanding and misrepresentation in the West and make his job one of the most challenging, but also one of the most rewarding. One of these misrepresentations is currently going on in Egypt. Athanasiadis explains.
It's easy as Westerners to kind of look at this as a pro-democracy movement. These people are rebelling for very, very different reasons than just the desire to have a sort of a Western-style parliamentary system. In many cases, the sectarian groups like the Shiites, who have been oppressed for many years, and they're wanting expanded rights. So it's not necessarily reform-led, so much as sectarian-led in many cases. And this we're also seeing in Libya.
Athanasiadis has also uncovered these complexities in Afghanistan. He doesn't subscribe to traditional reporting, however, but prefers to talk to normal people.
I have been focusing on people themselves, on Afghans and their stories, which I'd argue have been quite underrepresented in the Western media. You're always getting stories from Afghanistan that are quoting American commanders, NATO commanders, European diplomats, and Western-trained U.S. or Canada residents, Afghan members of the government. So what about the people who have actually stayed in Afghanistan throughout the 30 years of interruptions and war that we've had since 1979 and the Soviet invasion? Those are the people whose voices I'm trying to throw a little bit more of the spotlight on.
When asked what these voices were telling him, he said that it was tough to generalize, but one of the counterintuitive things he has been hearing is that many of these people missed the Taliban era because they had the most security during that time. Athanasiadis says the other issues don't matter when fighting for survival.
Democracy and human rights are very nice things, but when your country's in civil war, you hardly have time to think about them. They almost become luxuries, right, when you don't have electricity or food to eat. So that was one of the counterintuitive things that I've been hearing a lot.
The Afghan National Army is expected to provide most of this security, but has struggled in this task. Athanasiadis notes that the flawed recruitment process has built an ineffective force.
There have been a lot of efforts made to build up the Afghan National Army to the point where soldiers on the ground accuse the more administratively minded folks in Kabul or in the Pentagon of pushing recruitment into wider parts of society and with greater speed, therefore sacrificing quality so they can meet targets that have been set to keep the politicians happy, to make it appear as if the Afghan National Army is a very strong institution, it's got great multitudes serving in it, and it can provide security around the country. But when you're hiring illiterates with no education and very little training and then sending them off into the battle zones of the South, that's not a very good recipe for getting security for the country.
But the ANA doesn't deserve all the blame. Athanasiadis believes the haphazard approach to international aid has compromised security. He spoke to a former mid-level Taliban commander who tried to live in the city and become an ordinary citizen. After an attack from a former enemy, however, he returned to violence.
He went up into the mountains where he started making some money by attacking different Afghan police installations, Afghan National Army installations, and then NATO troops themselves. And he told me very clearly that he was making different amounts of money set on the tariff, so he would get more money for hitting NATO soldiers than hitting Afghan National Police.
Athanasiadis asked the man where he was getting the money, and he said it came from higher-up Taliban commanders, who were in turn receiving it from a member of the ISI Pakistani intelligence.
Which was a strange dynamic, because the Pakistani intelligence are supposedly very close allies of the U.S. and collaborating in this war against terrorism.
Athanasiadis asked why they would be funding the insurgency.
He said, well, because they're allies with the U.S. and because they need more money from the U.S., they foment some trouble in order to be able to point out to eruptions of trouble in Afghanistan. Then they can justify receiving higher budgets to fight this terrorism, of course, putting themselves as specialists in counterinsurgency and having deep knowledge of the region and personal contact. So that was why he went up into the mountains.
Athanasiadis says the Taliban commander came down because the U.S. provided a reconciliation budget, trading money for Taliban weapons.
So when he came down from the mountain, he got paid this money. Many other promises that had been made to him, such as having a secure house in the center of Herat. Obviously, he was scared of reprisals from his former Taliban comrades, or having a security job in the new administration.
However, Athanasiadis says these rewards were not offered to him, and he was quite unhappy and thinking of going back into the mountains again.
It was interesting for me because it showed how American funds motivated him to stay up in the mountain. American funds motivated him to, well, indirectly American funds, obviously, but sort of American-motivated funds. They got him to come down off the mountain. And this also ties into sort of the hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars that are flowing into the Afghan economy every year that this presence continues.
He also touched on the irony of the situation, where often foreign aid went back to fund the resistance efforts against international soldiers. He explains the difficulty of transitioning former insurgents back into society.
Yeah, you're also talking about, you know, 30-year-olds or less who've never known any situation other than war. They don't have any skills aside from firing Kalashnikovs and setting ambushes. So what are these people supposed to do in some cases around the country in areas that a form of stability has been extended? These people are basically bought off. Basically, they shift from being gunmen for a local anti-Western warlord fighting the American troops to hanging around a construction site or a road development program and being effectively idle or supposedly protecting the area. It speaks to a very large problem of to what extent can such a population make the transition to a peaceful society and a sort of a productive economy.
Athanasiadis intended to return to Afghanistan and continue this reporting once the fighting season resumed, but the recent events in Libya brought him there instead. He's now in Benghazi, covering rebel actions and the situation on the ground. For War News Radio, with help from Jillian Ma, I'm Jared Nolan.
This is War News Radio. A report by Richard Sambrook, the former director of Global News for the BBC, asks, are foreign correspondents redundant? The study concludes that digital technology and economic pressures are rapidly changing the way international news is being reported and consumed. Kyle Crawford has more in this piece, first aired in December.
In the 1980s, the major American TV networks maintained about 15 foreign news bureaus. Now, there are fewer than six. Networks have shut down their foreign desks in Moscow, Paris, Tokyo, and Cairo, to name a few. In fact, today there are no network bureaus in India, South America, or Africa, except for a one-man bureau in Kenya. The study is based on Sambrook's experience with the BBC and interviews with a variety of newsmakers and news organizations. He starts by outlining the role that foreign correspondents have played for the last 100 years, and he writes, "We are now entering a new era, where they may no longer be central to how we learn about the world." The study notes a paradox, that even as traditional foreign correspondents become less prevalent, the opportunity to find out about the world is increasing. Andy Mendelson, chair of the Department of Journalism at Temple University, agrees that there has been a drop in the number of foreign correspondents, but he also notes a rising number of local journalists, as Sambrook's study does.
But for the last 20 years, 30 years, there's been a huge decline in the numbers of them, American reporters reporting overseas. The fact that there may be increasing numbers of local people, of local reporters doing some of this, may be a good thing, because we've had the amount of foreign news, international coverage, has been declining steadily over the last 20, 30 years.
Mendelson explains that local journalists can bring important context, both cultural and historical, to their reporting, but that there are also issues we have to be aware of.
I mean, I think that they can be just as good reporters as an American dropping in or living there. There's obligations and that they may feel different from different reporting concerns than an American reporter, which is good and bad. I mean, they may report things in different ways than an American reporter, and that may be a good thing. But it may also limit the story if they're protecting what they think of as their culture or something like that. So that's always an issue whenever you have an insider versus an outsider reporting on a place. But potentially, I think that those additional voices, used correctly, used properly, could be a very good thing for people.
Sambrook spoke to many journalists who note how easy it is to self-publish and share stories online with the advent of new communication technologies. However, with this increased competition and freely available news, networks are having to cut costs and cut their foreign correspondents. The study notes that social media is now leading, supplementing, and complementing what professional news organizations offer, providing fresh source material, and competing with traditional news for the public attention. In January 2010, some of the first reports of the earthquake in Haiti came through Twitter. Sambrook notes that the public looked to Twitter over traditional media to discuss and rally around the victims of the disaster. Mendelson also says that Twitter is a valuable tool, but that it doesn't help people grasp the context or the history of an event.
I mean, information is not knowledge. And I would even say it's not necessarily information, it's data. And data needs to be sorted and processed to make it useful to people. And a stream of just tweets is not necessarily helping most people understand a larger context.
He agrees with Sambrook that the way the news is being reported is changing, and he wants the public to realize that moving away from the model of traditional foreign correspondence is not a bad thing.
I just don't think we can keep romanticizing this idea that we need to have American foreign correspondents, that we're the only experts on a place other than our country, you know, in other countries. And I think that's the important thing, is there are experts and perspectives that we can learn a lot from without having them be American citizens.
To answer the question, are foreign correspondents redundant? Sambrook says no. It's true the way international news is reported is changing, but the central mission of correspondence is not. Foreign correspondents will continue to be crucial in bearing witness to international events. For War News Radio, I'm Kyle Crawford.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the link on our website.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Lewis Katz, Rosanna Kim, Amandine Lee, Christina Matamoros, Colin Smith, and Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm John McMinn. Until next time, thanks for listening.